Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Steve Schaefer, and I'm the director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. Thank you for being with us. I am pleased today to speak with two experts, Ted Kafalas and Jonathan Helton from the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii, about the regulatory environment in Hawaii, the ability to rebuild in Hawaii after the wildfires that severely damaged the city of Lahaina, and to explore what lessons can be learned from Hawaii's experience and applied to California's rebuilding efforts after the Pacific Palisades fires. Note, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on any issues, and the opinions expressed are those of the experts. So, Ted, Jonathan, thank you for being with us today. Before we get started, you know, tell us a little bit about yourselves and the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii. Ted, how about we start with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for having us, Steve. I mean, this is a really important issue. I work as the Director of Strategic Campaigns at Grassroot Institute and also work as our registered lobbyist. So I'm kind of on the ground working with legislators, the general public, bureaucrats, trying to find solutions to a lot of these common problems. Prior to moving to Hawaii, I was in, you know, DC, Virginia area, kind of where you are right now, Steve, and worked as government affairs and crisis communications professional representing companies like Tesla and FanDuel. But just a little bit more about Grassroot Institute. We were founded in 2001. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research organization. We're really dedicated to lowering the cost of living and trying to hold the government accountable. You know, this is, you know, especially apparent given the current situation in Lahaina, where we've been advocating for policy reforms that will streamline rebuilding and expand, you know, different housing options. One of our key principles is e hana kako, which quite literally translates to let's work together in Hawaiian. And so we really try to emphasize collaboration across different communities, as well as with the state legislature, the county councils, and different bureaucrats and agencies, just trying to get everybody to work together in one direction.
That's great. And Jonathan, how about yourself? What's your professional background, and what led you to Grassroot Institute?
Well, I work on the back end of what Ted does, so I manage a lot of our policy research, especially in the realm of housing and county level work, especially focused on property taxes, permitting, and zoning. So when Ted's meeting with lawmakers, I'm often trying to read up on what regulations are doing. And I'm trying to find stories of people who have been affected by these regulations. I sort of have a different story of getting to Grassroot. I joined Grassroot several years ago through a connection related to high school debate and arguing about a federal law known as the Jones Act, which is a really important topic, probably for another time.
That's great. And what specifically drew you to the policy areas that you're currently working on?
You know, looking at Hawaii's housing environment, especially, Hawaii has the highest housing prices of any country, of any state in the country. And that's why that's become one of our big focuses recently, especially post-pandemic. Everywhere has seen higher prices, but in Hawaii, the prices were already high to begin with, and they increased extremely after the pandemic. So that's why we focused our efforts there.
And for people who aren't, you know, familiar with the regulatory system in Hawaii, I'm sure people are familiar with the natural beauty of Hawaii, but could you give some background on what the regulatory system looks like and what exactly does it take to build a house in Hawaii?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question, Steve. I think, you know, like you said, everybody's kind of, they know Hawaii for their natural beauty, but a lot of times we're kind of this island, you know, in the middle of the Pacific, in the middle of nowhere almost, and we can kind of be an afterthought for a lot of the folks on the mainland. But, you know, we deal with a considerable amount of regulatory hurdles when it comes to building homes here. There's a regulatory index from University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton Index, that ranks different states and different localities based on how restrictive they are on their land use policies. Hawaii is consistently number one. Our four counties are consistently ranked in the top 10 or 11 out of all the counties in the country when it comes to land use regulation. And that those restrictive housing regulations, you know, high home prices are typically a strong incentive for developers to build more homes, but the market can't really react because of all of these restrictions. You have a lot of homes that were built in like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, right after Hawaii gained statehood, where it was much easier to build. But nowadays, you really can't do that. And we're dwindling in the amount of homes that we're building. You know, we have like six layers. We call it like a six-layer cake here at Grassroot of housing regulations that you have to go through. You have the State Land Use Commission. You have things like the island plans, the community plans. Then there's like county zoning. You have historical districts. And if your property is near a shoreline, you have special management areas. So, you know, a lot of times we've seen it can take, you know, a decade plus to build a piece of a home from a raw piece of land. And that's just way too long, especially during an emergency like we've seen, you know, with the Lahaina fires.
And let me add something to what Ted just said. To put this into a number, the University of Hawaii's Economic Research Organization looked at the effect of regulations on condo prices, and regulation in Hawaii makes up 58% of the cost of a new condominium building. So, you know, when we say it's the Hawaii has the strictest housing regulations in the country, we mean it, and it's very clear that that's one of the reasons housing is so expensive here.
And in terms of, you know, the seven-layer cake and all these, you know, different land use regulations and possibly different, you know, you have the county and maybe some other entities that you have to work through. How does that impact, you know, the efficiency of rebuilding efforts, the speed, you know, especially after the horrifying fires in Lahaina?
Yeah, one of the county bureaucrats there on Maui, he said something that I think sort of sums it up. He said that, you know, Maui County in general is a pretty regulated place, but Lahaina is probably the most regulated place in Maui County. And the reason for that is because Lahaina was on the coast, and building on the coast in Hawaii always comes with more regulations. Also, it's a National Historic Landmark. So there's a lot of really old buildings, a lot of unique sites, and those are, you know, those face additional regulations if you want to build near there. So you have all of this, you have all of this eight layer cake, and it's all in Lahaina. So anyone looking to rebuild there has been facing a pretty uphill battle so far.
Yeah, I mean, just to build on what Jonathan was saying, that the current pace of rebuilding is just way too slow. So we're at 18 months now after the fire, and we have only six homes that have been rebuilt. That to me is unacceptable. There are people that are in temporary housing that are waiting to build their homes or waiting to get permits. And there's just a lot of folks that are in limbo. I do want to mention, I mean, there Lahaina has, and Maui County has approved over 160 permits. So, and that's a good number. I mean, people are starting, but there's a lot of different things. Jonathan mentioned these SMA permits, and if you're near a shoreline, you have to go through an additional process. Luckily, the mayor over in Maui has issued plans to temporarily suspend some of those rules. If you're inland of Front Street, which was right on the water. But, you know, there is question marks if you're a building that was on the opposite side of Front Street that is near the water, you are now going to have to go through SMA still. And that process can take up to a year in permitting. So, you know, I do want to commend Maui. You know, they did expedite those properties that were on the mountain side of the road. That's, I think, 600 plus properties that are now not going to have to go through that SMA permitting process. But, you know, it is important that all of these properties be able to rebuild what they lost.
Yeah, and just to add some context for what Ted's saying, you know, when we say that you face additional regulations and you're building near the coast, Hawaii has a special management area, and that's areas that they anticipate will be affected by sea level rise. But within that area, you have a second area referred to as the shoreline area, and that's even more restrictive. So you've got some of these properties that are right near the beach on Front Street in Lahaina, and so they're under SMA and shoreline. So, you know, we're talking about getting two sets of permits just to even start the process. Because even if you were able to get those two permits, you'd have to go through all of the other normal land use entitlement processes to just start rebuilding. So, you know, when we say this area is regulated, it's regulated up to the hilt.
Yeah. And just to continue our tag teaming here, you know, even with an SMA, you know, expediting process for those more inland properties, you know, they still have to comply with all the different regulations, whether it's historic district permits, there's the West Maui Community Plan, there's the Cultural Resources Commission, and then you have just like your standard county building permit. So like there's still a lot of layers that they have to get through just in order to rebuild.
And what does SMA stand for? Is that what is that particular?
SMA stands for a special management area. And again, okay. That's sort of the area of the coast that the state anticipates will be affected by sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you mentioned there was a second one at shoreline.
Yeah. Shoreline's even closer to the coast. So if you have like a beachfront home, that would be in the shoreline area as well as the SMA.
Thank you. And so, Ted, you had mentioned that in 18 months after the fires, only six homes have been built. I mean, for those who are not familiar with the damage that was done to Lahaina, like, is there a percentage or a raw number of buildings or homes or structures that were destroyed in Lahaina, just to give people unfamiliar with? Obviously, six homes is objectively a limited number, especially over 18 months. But how much of Lahaina was really devastated by the fires?
I think it was around, was it 1,100 properties, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think there were about 2,000 residential properties that were damaged to some extent is the number I've seen.
And has there been any response from SMA or, you know, Shoreline separately or anyone from the county with regards to why, you know, you have this 18 months that to only build six homes? Like, do they have a response? Or, you know, it could be well-intentioned, by the way. I you know, maybe this is just a new ground for them to till, but is there any response as to why things are currently as they are with the slowness?
I think the biggest part has been, at this point, has been Army Corps of Engineer. They took charge of actually cleaning up the debris from some of these lots. And so it wasn't the county or the state who was in charge there. So their debris cleanup on the residential side, they finished in just under a year. So I think it was July 2024 when they finished the residential cleanup. And they've just now finished the commercial cleanup, I think in January. So that's part of the delay. And it's not to say that U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was particularly slow or anything, but no one was able to go in and rebuild until their lot was cleared. And so now that that's been done, you know, we're hopeful that we'll start to see more of these commercial properties submitting their applications now that they're cleared to go ahead and do that.
And I do think, though, that there is the government is taking a bit of a cautious approach when it comes to, like, you know, erosions. We talk about SMAs, whether it's special management area or the shoreline management area. And I know from talking with folks that are in Lahaina and county officials that there is a lot of concern with things like sea level rise and the changing of the shorelines. But that does seem a little overly conservative. I mean, I appreciate the need for a lot of these proactive measures. But at the same time, we should be allowing people to rebuild what was lost. You know, this kind of cautious, proactive approach wasn't necessarily there to protect the people's properties from the fire. So, you know, we really need to look at ways to rebuild. There's businesses out there like Star Noodle and Mala Tavern in Lahaina that didn't burn down. They are on, as I mentioned, right on the water, beautiful restaurants. These places are thriving. Now, why are we not allowing all of these businesses to be rebuilt and give them that same chance to thrive again?
And in the broader context, you know, Hawaii hasn't had a major natural disaster in decades. The last one being Hurricane Iniki in 1992. Is there anything from that rebuilding experience that can be applied to the rebuilding of Lahaina?
This was one of the first things we looked at because Hawaii does not have a lot of experience in disaster management like California does. So we wanted to see, you know, what did Kauai County do well after Iniki hit there in 1992? So just for some context of where Kauai was, 11 months after the fire, they had issued about 3,400 residential permits for rebuilding and repair. Now, you know, as Ted mentioned, we're you know, I think the last time I checked, Maui was at almost 300 rebuilding permits for repair. So 18 months later, they're nowhere near as close as Kauai was at the time. So, you know, we identified a couple of things that Kauai did really well. The first was to open an Office of Emergency Permitting. And this was accomplished in just a couple months after the hurricane struck. The FEMA paid for some private contractors to come in and run an office that would expedite the issuance of building permits. Maui County did listen to that, and it took them a lot longer to set that up, but that office is finally running. And to date, the office is issuing permits a lot faster than the county is. The county average to wait on a building permit is about 200 days, but with the private contractor now helping expedite rebuilding, I think their average is 80 days, which, you know, frankly, is still a long time, but it's a whole lot better than your 200-day wait. So we were hopeful that, you know, that got passed.
And, you know, you noted that, you know, the Grassroot Institute has, you know, obviously is in, you know, policy proposals and things of that nature. What are some specific, you know, policies that you think would, you know, streamline the rebuilding process in Lahaina? And if those have been received, what are the status of those efforts?
Yeah, I think what we've seen, I mean, as I mentioned, the mayor, Mayor Bisson, is kind of relaxed some of those SMA rules. I know there's some bills right now to do the same thing, but really kind of fortify it in law. There's a few other rules, though. So there's another one that is being proposed that would essentially say that these properties could rebuild even if they didn't conform to current codes. So one of the problems with an old place like Lahaina is a lot of those buildings don't like fall under the current building codes, and they're illegal to build, you know, essentially what was lost. So I think it allows people to, it just makes sense to allow people to rebuild those things. There's another one that would allow certain properties to not have to pay building permit fees. And, you know, that sounds small, but for some of these bigger properties, so I was talking with the owner of the Pioneer Inn, which was a hotel right on Front Street. He was estimating one of his building permits could cost $500,000. That's significant. A lot of these people are still waiting on their insurance payouts to come through, and they don't have that kind of cash. not to mention, I mean, I don't think the government should necessarily be profiting from people that are, you know, just trying to rebuild what they lost. So, you know, trying to exempt some of those problems. And really part of the problem is that there's been no clear path forward for the longest time. So that's what we're trying to help provide, working with the local and state officials to just try to look through all of these different possibilities. Jonathan mentioned Hurricane Iniki. What did we do then that worked well? What did we do that didn't work so well? And what can we learn from our past in order to really facilitate a bright future?
And I want to share a story based off of something Ted said. So he mentioned the nonconformity rules. So if your property you know, didn't meet the current zoning code because it was really old, you know, then it would have to be rebuilt to the current zoning code. There's a church in Lahaina called Waiola Church. It's one of the oldest churches in Maui. And of course, you know, the building has been replaced several times, but the current building they've had there has been, I think it was there since the 50s. That building was severely damaged in the fire. But zoning came along at some point, and that church is in a residential zone. And Maui County Code does not allow churches or temples or any sort of religious meeting place in residential zones. So if you want to have a church in one of those zones, you have to get a special permit from the County Planning Commission. That's a process that takes a really long time. And so one of the measures that the Maui County Council would do is it would waive those sort of rules. It would say, hey, if you had a structure that didn't meet zoning code, or if you had a use such as a meeting place that didn't meet zoning code, you know, before the fire, we're going to waive those rules so you wouldn't have to get all these sorts of special exemptions to rebuild just what you had. And so, you know, it's not this one church. There's probably half a dozen churches that are in the same spot in Lahaina, and, you know, countless other buildings that, because they were built 50, 60, 70 years ago, just don't line up with what's on the books now. And so waiving some of those zoning rules would help them rebuild, and it would hopefully keep some of the town's historic charm.
And what's the so Ted had previously mentioned, you know, the cost, a $500,000 cost or something like that for, let's say, a commercial, you know, somebody who owns commercial real estate. What's the response, you know, of the everyday, you know, Hawaiian who lost a small business or their house or something like that? Is there any clear response from them, or are they shell-shocked just by the whole? I'm just thinking about how your everyday American or someone who's listening to this podcast right now might, how would you navigate this if you weren't a commercial property owner? How would you navigate this if you don't have access to like an attorney or attorneys?
Yeah, I've got another story an entire bank of stories from Lahaina, but one comes from an individual named Joe Pluta. He is the head of the West Maui Taxpayers Association. He has been in Lahaina, you know, for forever almost, and he was telling me this, you know, horrible story about him waking up to the fires essentially in his face, and he had to jump out of a window. Well, in the months since, he's faced another monster, and that's the government bureaucracy. And so he, again, has no path forward. He's reached so many roadblocks, so many question marks, that he actually sold his property to his next door neighbor, who I think ran a bed and breakfast. But, you know, he has not said that he's leaving Maui or anything like that. I think he's relocated on the island. But he said, I just can't. He's 75 years old, Steve. I mean, he can't wait 5 to 10 more years for the county to kind of get their act together and allow him to rebuild.
And so, like, you know, I think people saw, you know, how shocking it was seeing the fires in Lahaina. And I, one of the reasons that I wanted to ask you all your insights and analysis from your experience responding to the rebuilding efforts was the recent fires in the greater Los Angeles area. And, you know, I wanted to hear from you all, you know, what lessons do you think Los Angeles could learn from the recovery efforts in Maui?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we mentioned a lot of the bureaucracy, a lot of the red tape that's holding things up. I think that can be a little bit of a forecast for what's ahead in Los Angeles. I mean, if you just look at the scales, the LA fires made Lahaina look small. And at the time, Lahaina was one of the most devastating wildfires in U.S. history. So it just goes to show you the impact that people are going to feel in Los Angeles. And really the need to even expedite even further. You know, Jonathan referenced 2,000 structures in Lahaina that burned down. You know, there are exponentially more in California and in LA that have burned to the ground. So being able to expedite a lot of those permitting processes, I know the governor has made mention over there, Governor Newsom, of trying to cut through red tape, which we are surely in support of. But it really is a shame that it takes a sort of disaster like this to really drill down and see what is hurting these things. You know, Lahaina was dealing with a housing shortage before the fires. Hawaii as a whole was dealing with a housing shortage. Same with California and LA. You know, they're dealing with these massive shortages and nobody was really doing anything. I mean, there were some small little bills passed, and now we're starting to see some action. I'm just hopeful that the wheels get started and that the folks in LA are not having to wait as long as people in Lahaina are to rebuild.
And go ahead, Jonathan.
I was going to say, I think there's hope if you live in California and you're listening to this. You know, a lot of the ideas that we've seen been discussed in Maui have been some ideas that were taken from recovery from previous California fires. So just as an example, the 2018 Paradise fires in California, Maui County had hired the same permit expediter that handled the rebuilding there to manage the rebuilding in Lahaina. So I do think there's a lot more institutional knowledge in California about how to recover from a wildfire. So, you know, I would certainly be hopeful if I had lost my home in Los Angeles that the state of California can manage that rebuilding a little bit better than they're doing it here in Hawaii.
And Ted had referenced, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom, governor of California, currently cutting through red tape. Are there any similarities that you all saw with what Governor Josh Green did?
Yeah, I want to give Governor Newsom some credit and what California is doing, because I mentioned about cutting red tape. Whether it's waiving regulatory or environmental laws so that people can build back quicker. I think that has been really good. I think, again, we just want people to get back into their homes. But I do want to caution, there were a couple, it's not all good necessarily. There were a couple of executive orders, one dealing specifically with what they were calling speculators. And essentially saying that you could not go and these developers couldn't try to buy this land that had burned down, which sounds good on paper, sounds like, oh, yeah, we shouldn't want these people speculating on land. But as we've seen in Lahaina, you know, these families might have been able to take that money and go start a new life for themselves, go build a new house somewhere else on island. So by taking away that ability, it really kind of hurts the free market and really is kind of tying people's hands to their land that is burned to the ground right now. So, you know, that's something that, again, on its surface sounds good. When you really drill down deep, there's some negative impacts. You know, there's another one here in Lahaina that we saw where a lot of folks were actually evicting current tenants in order to house a lot of the fire victims because they were getting more money from FEMA in order to do so. So, you know, there's some negative impacts, as I mentioned, that kind of go contrary to what you think originally. You think, well, we should really want to house these people. We're going to pay, you know, $5,000, $6,000 for a two-bedroom unit. And as a landlord, these people are looking to cash in almost. So you end up with people that are getting thrown out on the streets that haven't lost their homes in favor of people that did. So it's kind of creating a weird system of haves and have nots. And I do think that we need to be cautious, especially with some of these heavy-handed emergency proclamations.
You know, the governor of Hawaii threatened to do something similar and prevent people from offering to buy the properties of those who lost their homes in Lahaina. He made those comments right after the fires happened. He didn't follow through in issuing any sort of ban. And, you know, as Ted has mentioned, you know, there have been some people who have decided to sell and either move off the island completely or just relocate to other parts of Maui. So that, you know, that ability to leave if you want to can be pretty empowering to some folks.
And what's so, you know, with the prior comments about people being displaced from where they're being housed, what's happening? You know, what are some of these obstacles that exist for people who need temporary housing?
Go on ahead, Jonathan.
I can say the temporary housing question, you know, that's something that we were anticipating there would be a lot of temporary homes built very quickly because we thought there would be urgency after the fire. And, you know, unfortunately, there wasn't that level of urgency. The state, you know, Hawaii's lucky because we have a lot of hotels. So the state and FEMA paid to put a lot of the people who were displaced in hotels in Maui. But in terms of getting that next level of transitional housing, you know, it took in some cases almost a year to really get housing on the ground. You know, Ted is probably going to tell a story, but there's a nonprofit in Maui that had modular homes on the ground within a month mm-hmm. of the fires, and they were ready to go. And I think even to this day, they haven't gotten all of the permits from the county to open those homes to folks. And that's, you know, it's just an example of the number of approvals they had to go through. They had to navigate their zoning. And then the county said, oh, well, you've got to have these particular sort of water hookups. So they were trying to find access to drinking water instead of just being able to, you know, bring in some big barrels of water just to, you know, really make it a temporary shelter. The county was treating it like it needed to be something permanent. And, you know, a lot of the temporary projects were in the same boat where one rule or another, you know, they got stuck. A lot of people who would have built temporary housing didn't even try because they knew what it would take. And they were like, you know, this isn't worth it. We'll try to help in some other way.
Yeah. I mean, I know multiple projects that were proposed under the governor's emergency proclamation that were focused on this kind of temporary housing. But again, it's a lack of clarity, quite honestly. I mean, and there's a lot of developers and these are even nonprofit organizations that they didn't want to go through the process, spend the resources for a project that might be taken down after the emergency proclamation. They've extended some of the timelines for the temporary housing now, but it's still a calculated risk when it comes to building homes. And, you know, a big part of that is having the certainty to make sure that the project is sustainable in the future. I don't know a lot of people that would spend millions and millions of dollars on something to then say in 5 years, oh, well, you have to tear it down now. You know, Hawaii has been dealing with a massive housing shortage, as we've mentioned, even before the fires. So it's unconscionable to me that we would be tearing down perfectly good units when we're still dealing with a housing shortage.
And what role do outdated fixture unit rules play in limiting the recovery process in Maui?
Yeah, this is one of those really, really weird rules that gets in the way. So Maui has rules related to plumbing. So basically, you know, if you're going to hook into the county water system, they're going to limit the number of water using appliances in your house. Okay, so they're going to put a limit on the number of toilets, sinks, hose bibs, etc. Okay, so that's complicated to start with. But to make it even more complicated, the county hadn't updated any of these rules since 1995. And so anyone who's looking to rebuild, maybe they have a little bit of extra insurance money, and so they're going to add like a little granny flat to their home, or they're going to make their home a little bigger, add a backyard cottage. A lot of these people have gotten letters from the Department of Water Supply that say, hey, you have exceeded your limit of, you know, showers, sinks, and toilets. So you need to go in and amend your plans, or pay a bunch of extra money in fees so you can have these extra units. And we've had so many bizarre stories that people have told us about this rule where, you know, they're wanting to add something to their home, so they will tear out water units from one place in their home so that they can get their building permit approved. And it just created all of these strange scenarios. So, you know, thankfully, the county council recognized that we need to update these rules that haven't been updated in 30 years. And so they did pass a bill back in January that's telling the Department of Water Supply, like, okay, guys, you need to modernize how you assess people fees for using water. It needs to be based on more than, you know, just the number of toilets in their house. And so, you know, we're hopeful water supply will really come up with something that works. And you know, that didn't fix the problem immediately. But you know, hopefully over the next 6-8 months, they will get something together that people won't have to juggle this, you know, just another weird rule.
And is it regulatory inertia, or what is it? You know, ostensibly the people that are working in the county council, you know, they're not trying to hurt people. So what do you attribute the fact that, you know, things had not been updated since 1995 in terms of, you know, water hookup rule?
In general, on Maui, there is sort of a skepticism of really big development coming in and totally changing the landscape. You know, a lot of the islands in Hawaii, you know, don't want to become Honolulu. They don't want skyscrapers everywhere. And so you do have some anti-development sentiment that I think, you know, compounding with the fact that a lot of county agencies are really short-staffed, there's high turnover rates. You add all that together, and it's a really good recipe for, as you said, inertia. Things don't change because there's not a lot of people who are out there pushing for things to change. But when you have a fire, you need to build things quickly. There's a spotlight shown on all of these inefficiencies. And thankfully, some of those inefficiencies look like they're going to get corrected.
So I know some of our listeners have probably heard of NIMBY, not in my backyard, or those kind of laws or regulations. But could you guys explain what is Yes in God's Backyard, YGBY? What are those laws, and what do they do, and how could they contribute one way or the other to Maui's recovery efforts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been growing recognition, especially here in Hawaii, that you know, faith-based organizations can really help address the housing crisis. In the state legislature, they passed a resolution last year asking the counties to essentially look into their ordinances to allow churches, schools, medical institutions to build housing on land that they already own. The problem is a lot of this land that these, you know, nonprofits, let's say a church, for example, owns is not necessarily residential, as Jonathan mentioned. And in the example Jonathan used, the church was actually on residential, but more often than not, they are on what's called like quasi-public or public zoned land. And Steve, I know we've talked about this months ago, but you know, there was a project that was the Community Church of the Nazarene. They tried building some homes. I think Jonathan, you even referenced this earlier. They were trying to build some homes. The parcel, from my understanding, is like almost 100,000 square feet. But it's zoned public, and so you can't put housing on that land. So they built, you know, all four walls. They pretty much had everything put together except the roof. And the county came in and said, nope, you have to stop work. This is not zoned for residential. We can't have this. So, you know, it's hurting groups like that that want to help the communities. You know, there's a lot of these developer or a lot of these nonprofits, they're not viewed as major housing providers, even though they have prime real estate in urban and suburban areas. So what YGBE is trying to do, and Yes in God's Backyard, is really just trying to allow them to do what they do best, and that's serve the communities. You know, these are groups that they want to help, but they haven't had necessarily a unified push on the state level or county level. And quite frankly, there's a lot of complexity. So, you know, as a church, we talked about this year-long battle. Sometimes it takes 10 years. There's the 7-8-layer cake that you have to get through. As a church, you're not focused on that. Or as a school, you're not focused on that. You have so many other things going on. So adding, you know, trying to get through a process like that makes it to the point where a lot of these groups don't follow through. And they just say, well, you know, it's not worth it for us. Even though we want to help, we want to be there, it's just not worth all the headaches. So, you know, there's a lot to learn. California did a similar bill. I think it was SB4. That we've actually been trying to do a model here in Hawaii based off of. SB4, you know, allows churches, nonprofits to build housing by right, which is huge. It means if a project meets zoning and safety standards, it can move forward without discretionary approvals. It removes a lot of delays and lawsuits that can kill projects. You know, I mean, SB4 isn't without some of its issues. There's like a 55-year affordability requirement. They require, you know, prevailing wages, which obviously drive up the cost of construction projects. So there are some things that we can improve upon, but we're really hopeful that the state, as well as the counties, will take this up and really allow these nonprofits to get involved in the housing shortage.
And Ted and Jonathan, if our listeners want to find out more about the work that you all do at the Grassroot Institute of Hawaii, where could they find that work?
Easiest place is Grassroot. That's Grassroot with no S, institute.org. We've got policy briefs. You know, we're really active on Instagram. So you can, you know, go to our website. There's a link to our Instagram. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Those are the two best ways to learn more about us. And, you know, Ted and I are always happy to chat with anyone about housing policy, rebuilding Lahaina, and happy to offer what lessons that, you know, we've learned for, you know, anywhere in the U.S. that's faced with these similar issues.
Well, Ted and Jonathan, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your insights and analysis. For more information like this on regulation and the American way of life, please visit regproject.org. That's regproject.org. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.